Well, I think that the challenge in bringing together something like spirituality development is that at the first level, integration has to take place in each individual person. You are the one who needs to integrate your spirituality and your profession, your activities, your lifestyle, and so on and so forth. In my own life, I suppose I had the advantage that I was able to start as a Baha'i and pick my career as an application of Baha'i principles. I picked ecology because it was a Baha'i way of thinking about science, the harmony of the whole, the questions of balance, the unity of the whole system. And all the way through my life, I have tried to maintain that linkage, to maintain some kind of a coherent unity to what I was doing between my own individual spiritual life, my social life, you know, as a Baha'i, my professional life, working in the United Nations, working with science, and trying to always maintain the linkages among the levels. It's like, what are the spiritual principles that apply into what I'm doing now? I'm working with governments. How do I inspire them? But the hardest part of that has always been to get other people to also appreciate that those levels do in fact come together. We're living in a world where it's unfashionable, if not considered downright bad, to talk about religion or to try and say there might be a relationship between religion and governance, religion and science, and so on. And overcoming that prejudice in our society is an enormous challenge. But this is changing. I just, the last 2 weeks, was teaching an advanced course in environmental diplomacy to 30 diplomats and top people from 25 countries. And I organized a module on ethics, religion, and science for environmental diplomacy. And apart from a few confirmed skeptics, the people said, we've never thought about this before in that way. You know, we've been diplomats 15, 20 years, and it never occurred to us that values were important to what we were doing. Now that we've thought about it, it suddenly makes sense. And it was helping them integrate in their own lives. So I think this is a quick message. That's the integration that we need to be looking for, you know, individually and collectively. And we were hoping that this panel would sort of illustrate that. So we have very distinguished professionals from a variety of kids on this panel. And they have been sharing with us their perspective, often at the professional level. We were hoping that in this more informal opportunity, we could build those bridges and share them with you as well.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. Okay, I'm going to start with just one sentence from Baha'u'llah, founder of the Baha'i Faith, where he says, O children of dust, tell the rich of the midnight sighing of the poor, lest heedlessness lead them into the path of destruction and deprive them of the tree of wealth. So, tell the rich of the midnight sighing of the poor. And in the talks yesterday and today, there's been an effort to tell us, all of us, living in the rich part of the world, the privileged part of the world, materially speaking, of the sighing of the poor of tomorrow. And that unless, and the sighing that they will suffer and express unless we initiate really significant transformations in our life and societies. Global warming will clearly be an enormous challenge for both inter- and intergenerational equity, that is equity within the generation living now and between our generation and the next one. And just as it is impossible to imagine, from my personal perspective, that it will be possible to relieve inequity among ourselves living today, we know we haven't achieved it, without some source of motivation that moves us beyond narrow self-interest. Just the same way, it will be impossible to motivate the scale of action, the scale of collaboration, and necessary to mitigate gross injustice towards future generations through climate change, without evoking a truly altruistic aspiration for the common good of mankind. But this also means that there is enormous potential to engage members of the faith communities around the world in this gigantic endeavor to mitigate global warming. Because all faith communities are drawing from their writing the altruistic love for their neighbor that's common to all religions. And what we need to learn is how to practice our life for tomorrow's neighbors and the next centuries and the millennia. very much.
Father, can we ask you?
Yeah, well, just things come to mind there. One thing is the whole issue of motivation to do something about a challenge like this and have the courage and perhaps the faith in the future to actually do something. And you might think that at an international level that these things don't boil down to governments, but it quite often boils down to individual characteristics. And the people that I come across in this work that have quite often had most influence of the direction, there have also been people that have portrayed valuable spiritual movements. And so I think there's something I can't think about this. But there's something deeply spiritual about caring about not just the environment, but the human aspect of this issue. And I don't want to necessarily name individuals, but there's one person that has been quite quickly come out of the closet, if that's the term, in terms of his speeches. John Hilton, I quote him. And he has been quite active as a Christian. And he actually crossed the Atlantic and taught to Christian organizations in the United States. And they, certainly, one of them, they discovered that one of them was one of those bad people who was a scientist telling them there was a problem. And so he was able to bridge the gap because of the trust that that brought to the audience, that this is the person that is deeply issues, that he has come to this conclusion. And that triggered for them an interest. The other reason, other issue of spirituality, I think I think is quite important here, is that is how to translate some of these abstract things like numbers or graphs and projections about the future into something that is a bit closer. And so I think it's a lot easier to do something, so to bring sometimes we talk about it emotional, but I don't see if you vision in the there are people that that are coming across as being emotional. It's partly because it touches them a bit deeper than, in other words, it doesn't leave them when they leave the office. It's kind of something like the ego. And I've seen so many people in our work in this kind of process that really have had this disproportionate impact because they have been able to articulate why and what happened.
Thank you very much, Minu. It's very much my observation what Colette was saying, and I find those kinds of people, you find them unexpectedly faced with some bureaucratic negotiator, so you see that why that person has chosen to do a career in an environment which still is not something that would be really jumping into your career or jumpstart your career very much. So you find quite a lot of those kinds of people in working on environment and sustainable development issues who do have a deep caring. Some of them might not know it, but I go into this with that kind of prejudice. And that is, of course, my own motivation. I find it incredibly, incredible privilege to be able to work on issues and in a way that allows me to express some of my spirituality and joy. That's a wonderful thing. I think one will need to be much more mature than I am to be able to express that in any kind of work, which I think is something to aspire to. But in this area, it's actually very easy. What strikes me about recent developments over the last 10, 15 years, but more recently I see the world going up, is an understanding in the community of the need to look at how we talk to each other, how we work together, focus on process. But I was talking today about the informal dialogue that is happening around the intervention process and the task force intervention. And I was so pleased to hear how much staff time and effort goes into that, and not just hosting it and your elephants and everything. And that is for me an example where three things really fell into place, and that very much reflects the way I was brought up. One is values of justice, of mutual respect, of mutual understanding, of mutual accommodation in the community to find a way, kind of values that I was taught in school. The other was what we know from social psychology, from organizational psychology. Jasmine actually did the review of that literature a few years ago, to look at what is it that we learn from the research, what actually makes us tick as groups, and what makes us tick in a dialogue or in a consultation in a relationship process. And thirdly, there's this quality of sustainable development and the explicit need to involve stakeholders and communities in the way we deal with our challenges. And the consultation principles that I grew up with, because I grew up in my family, actually put into one place with what says in Agenda 21 about the social about the societal groups being involved and what we know from research what actually these groups work. So in other words, it for me this was like, wow, you know, so if actually it comes from all sides, and that's something where we need to sort of put a spotlight on. And I mean there's a number of processes going on that reflect that need for good process and for dialogue and consultation. For example, ICN, the World Conservation Union, initiated a process for the future of sustainability. And what's coming up there is that the future of sustainability will largely rely on the way we need to interact with the world.
Thank you. Augusto.
It occurs to me that what I will do is I will share with you an anecdote. Because I am in front of a group of people who are environmentalists at heart. And my anecdote has to do with environment. And I'm not exactly sure which point I'm trying to illustrate, but it's a nice anecdote anyway. And this is actually something that happened to me in 2005. It was probably one of the nicest days of 2005 for me, one that I will always remember and I will treasure in my heart. I was asked I was invited to a meeting of an organization called the Private Wealth Council, which is actually a club of billionaires I guess international, but they meet regularly in Switzerland. Where else? Now, I want to make it absolutely clear that I was not invited as a member of that group.
Too bad. What a shame. I was asking for a loan.
I was invited because Al Gore was going to make a presentation to this group, a talk, the 9 drivers of global change. And so, together with a professor from INSEAD, the business school, we were invited to comment on his talk for a few minutes. And so I went. You know, we were meeting in a 6-star hotel in the outskirts of Zurich in July of last year. And it was kind of a challenging assignment because I hadn't been given, neither the professor from INSEAD had been given with a copy of the speech, so we didn't really know what he was going to talk about. We knew that there was 9 drivers of global change, but you know, beyond that. So I prepared some generally broad remarks, you know, which could be adjusted along the way in light of the speech. And so, as it turns out, he gave 2 speeches. One of them was the PowerPoint presentation, which has been the basis for the film, The Seeking Truth, which I encourage you to watch. It's a powerful piece of work. When he presented it on that day at this meeting, the response from the 50 people in the audience was really quite overwhelming. It was really very emotional. It was complete silence at the end of the presentation, and then everybody stood up, and it was just massive applause, and it was a sense of admiration, because it was delivered with such passion and understanding. But in any case, then he went, he delivered the speech on which I was supposed to comment, which I did. And then what I did not know, which was really where the story begins to get interesting, was that after lunch, this group of 50 people were broken into 10 small groups, 5 persons each, to discuss a global issue. We were presented with a problem, and we had to discuss the problem, and then come back to the group later on in the afternoon with the sensible discussions. And I was assigned to the Al Gore group. So together with 3 other persons, there were 5 of us, we got to spend 4 hours in the afternoon discussing all manner of things. And then I really, really got to know Al Gore very well, because the discussions were very intimate. And because the nature of the problem was such that eventually, little by little, we got into environment, politics, ethics, religion, spirituality, human relationships, this day and age, fundamentalism, you know, the whole range of issues. And then at some point in the middle of the afternoon, it occurred to me that it might be appropriate for me to say something like, from my perspective, I'm paraphrasing myself, I can't remember exactly how I put it, but I said something to the effect that in my opinion, the Baha'is have probably been the only ones that have come up with an understanding of religion which made it possible, you know, to think of reconciliation. And he looked at me and he said, group, and he said, you know, my wife and I have been associated with the Baptist Church for many, many decades. Our family in Tennessee goes back literally a long, long time, and we were always very active in the Baptist Church. But my wife and I no longer go to the Baptist Church because it has been taken over by fundamentalists. However, we have been there. We are very, very comfortable in the spirit. It no longer reflects what we really look at religion. Therefore, he said, my wife and I, he always spoke about his wife. He's known to have this very, very close relationship with his wife. So with us, the two of us, he said, we consider ourselves to be people in search of religion. And then he looked at me and says, maybe one day we'll become alive. At this point, you know, I had not said that I was alive. But then again, we continued on. I decided not to pursue that one. But then, after this, there was a dinner, you know, this big hall, and so I come to the entrance of the dining room, and there's this piece of paper with the table's drawn, and the names of the people sitting around the table, and lo and behold, I am in the bottom of the table again. So, why not? It's like a formal evening to have. So, the dinner begins at 8, and promptly standing there at 8:01, Al Gore shows up. And he says, oh, you're a Baha'i. He said, yes, I am. Oh, interesting. But you know, one thing that I have never really liked about the Baha'is is that you guys don't vote. No. That's not quite true. And then I went and explained the distinction between not being a party member or a political party and that exercise of civic duty, which was quite right. We Baha'is vote. And so he was thankful for the clarification. And then he said, you know, I quoted in my book the founder of the Baha'i Faith. And this is where he really was impressed, modesty aside. You see, in the morning, all of the participants had been presented with a copy of his book. So at lunchtime in my room, I quickly looked at the quote, it happened to be something that I knew by heart. And so when he mentioned that he had quoted the founder of the Baha'i Faith's book, I said, oh, yes, I know. And this is what you quoted. He was very impressed. Not only was he impressed at my ability to quote what he had written 15 years before, but most importantly, he was impressed because what he quoted was really good. It was a wonderful quote where Rahabat talks about how civilization, you know, when it is not kept with the devout cooperation, will prove as prophetic as also evil. You remember that?
Are you not going to actually quote it for us?
Yeah, because I presume that you all know it. And so we just had a delightful evening. But I must tell you, I came out of that day, and that wasn't the end of it. After the dinner, there was a workshop, and so two groups. I went to the outdoor group, of course. So in the end, I ended up spending the whole day with you. And I assure you, I came out of that process with enormous respect. Enormous respect. His intelligence, his grasp, his quickness of mind, but his humanity really was quite amazing. And so I just thought that you might appreciate that. It is an anecdote which I think I have told to 3 people, my wife included, and I thought it would be appropriate to share.
Thank you very much. It's a very good anecdote. Well, you can see the diversity of interests and concerns that we have here. And you also have that same range of interests and concerns. In fact, when I looked at these questions today that you handed in, we have about 20 questions. I'm not sure we're going to get to all of them. But they sort of neatly fell into different categories, which you could broadly call a controversial. Political questions, questions on how politically we can take some of these issues forward, questions about what we can do as individuals, questions about what communities can do, and what you might call scientific or technical questions, in other words, you know, the techno-fix issues. And we have one question on what I would call values and ethics, which I think we'll leave for the end if we have a chance to do it. So we're going to start with the political questions today, and I've got Abigail. Abigail, are you here? Would you like to ask your question? To perhaps start on that, just a very brief, and panel, if you have a, if you disagree, you can say so, or you.
Well, the question of incentives for action by business are very complex because they are functioning within a Western economic system that has a very narrow set of values, of incentives, profit incentives. You know, the managers are judged by how, you know, what they're returning to the shareholders. They're not being judged on their moral responsibility. In many ways, the economic incentives are all wrong. And then, so what you try to say, well, we need to go in some other different direction. The first thing you have to change is the framework for the incentives themselves. Until you change that, anybody who steps too far out of line, off goes their head. You know, that it's very, you know, it's, and I think Al Gore is the perfect example of somebody who wrote this very profound book on global issues, environmental issues, quoting from Baha'u'llah, spent 8 years as vice president of the United States and having essentially no impact of his ideas on what happened in the American system. And now he's out of, you know, again, he's beginning having impact by being able to communicate. But he was paralyzed, he was trapped within the system that essentially gave him no room to maneuver. I think the same is true with, you know, many of the businesses and institutions of our society. As long as they're trapped in the system, it's very hard for them to be courageous and take steps that are needed. And the, I think the challenge that we therefore face is to say, how far can you still do within the system? I mean, how far can you go without becoming unprofitable and therefore, you know, disappearing and failing in your basic purpose? Because some business doesn't make a profit, sooner or later it goes bankrupt. It's a practical reality. But also, are there ways that you can actually go around the problem? And first, there are incentives for cleaner production, for energy efficiency that also have benefits at the profit level. Use less energy, and they'll be more efficient, and you're reducing carbon emissions, but it's also good for the bottom line. So it's finding the win-win situations, it's finding how far you can go on the other side, and being ready if the situation changes, to be able to leap rapidly, something new. Like, be able to, in a time of very rapid change, perhaps disruption, those businesses, people who are ready to change quickly when the opportunity opens up, to be creative and to go forward in the right direction, will be what helps to make the difference. It's not a perfect answer to your question, but it's in some dimensions.
Do you want to hop in on that one? No. Sylvia, anything on this one? Any other? Yeah.
I mean, you were asking for incentives for businesses and individuals.
Do you want to just stand up? I think the people at the back are strong. Buy out this before. already capitalized. They already have the money. They're already in that market position. They've already got their markets. They don't really need, I mean, okay, if there's a regulation, if I'm understanding you, if there's a regulation that comes in that says you can't have emissions above so-and-so, but you can trade them in a poor country over here, they just go, they have the money to go over and buy those emissions. And not only that, but to collect, to not just to go to one place, to go to a lot of places, and thereby capitalizing, using the money that they've already built on the back of already, unsustainable practices, to continue those unsustainable practices because you're financed poor, or in another location. It's that kind of your drift, and I think, Holder, you wanted to commit on that.
Well, I actually think that the issue is too urgent for us to depend on persuasion on this issue. I really think we've changed the rules of the game. And so you have to direct answer to your question, what is the incentive? It's almost nothing. There's really not. And I think you have to face those facts and with those incentives can be created. And that's why I'm quite attracted to a little bit taking a rule-based approach to this, to actually make the market rules work. In this direction, but you were interested in this link between then north-south, and the good thing about this mechanism that I mentioned is that you're connecting completely different interests, but they actually work together. A company here needs the emission credits because they have a certain thing. Company in India might be interested in investing in an improved production process, and it's difficult to attract investors. You can actually marry those two interests and make it work. And so I think we really have to think about different things, especially as show up in the bottom line.
I refer to the development mechanism, which is, I think, for me, an example of the fact that you need rules and you create, but you don't overrule. Now you leave space for creativity. It's a bit like the discussion on CSR or other things, when we often hear from the business side, we want to do everything voluntarily, and that's where we're good at, and all of that. But as we heard from Augusta today, the companies judge countries by, for example, good governance, functioning judiciary systems, and so on. So there are rules that create environment and makes it attractive. Just if I may add, on the individual level, because I'm a psychologist, I think we have a fatal misunderstanding if we believe that values drive our behavior, and that is that the relationship between values and behavior is actually quite big. And human behavior is driven by a number of things, among others, values, practice, knowledge, and information. There's social acceptance and social status. There's the opportunity to act in a particular way that drives our behavior just as much. And that, adds to the argument from before, in the dating environment, that people can live their values, for example. This is
just very quickly, in terms of your concern, it is true. So which country will be able to buy these credits. However, provided that in the aggregate, the sum total of emissions is still within a path that is descending and that is consistent with the goals of reducing its overall emission, then it's okay. I mean, trading will generate income for the poor countries. That's why, in principle, I don't see the problem. The problem would be if you have the trading which allows the rich countries to continue to pay. But the overall in aggregate is not kept within the second thing. That would be a
problem. And I suppose what happens then those companies that are part of the trading also become capitalized and presumably can move to a position where they can actually purchase when they need to, they can purchase it, and that money can continue to circulate.
Yeah. I mean, some calculations done for some of the countries that are sitting below the quota show that you can generate huge amounts of income. I've seen the calculations from Russia, for example.
one of the challenges in the present sort of globalization is the failure of weight and wealth to be the distribution. You know, the wealth is concentrating, but except in the in smaller and smaller hands. So any mechanism that helps redistribute wealth, that can bring wealth into the countries that need it and reduce the inequalities, is good for the overall system. And the important thing is it not be simple exploitation, but it actually be constructive investment that's being used to move towards sustainability and not simply exporting pollution and all the negative effects of pollution. Let the poor people die, not the rich people, because they aren't worth as much as the rich people, which is the way the economists would calculate.
Did you have another question to this? Or
observation?
It's an observation.
I agree, but
how that is.
I agree, but it depends on how that income from the credits is used. As we've seen, they've got a very bad record.
Any comment from the panel on that, or is that just a... Everybody's nodding their head on that.
That's the rules of the system to make sure that it's not free for all, but that it's being done with a really important measure of the
Abigail, we're going to close on this question. We've got about 20 questions here. It's a really hot issue. Did you have a last comment to make on this?
No, I know there is a right.
Okay. Bruce, I'm sorry. We're going to end the questions before they're fully answered. So, Bruce, read your question into the microphone. Next time, I think we need a roving mic.
What are the global ethical implications of Britain increasing its nuclear generation capacity?
Maybe we can just widen that out to other countries that are attempting to do that. Or might be doing it. Anybody have a...
Finland.
Oh,
from Germany, I'm fine.
Come on, Germans.
What am I supposed to say? We're phasing it out. We will continue to do that.
Okay, we're talking about ethical... We're talking about ethics here, and these are real-world concerns, aren't they? So, hello.
Actually, I think mankind doesn't have the luxury of excluding our solutions when it comes to the climate. We cannot have kind of a Swiss cheese problem. So in other words, I really don't see that you can deal with this problem without nuclear energy and actually come to that conclusion. But it is. It's very important how it's done. And one of the things that I did in my earlier incarnation working for the Icelandic government is to put consistent pressure on, since we mentioned the UK government, to stop releasing technetium from their nuclear processing facility in South Africa. And so there's a host of issues around nuclear that need to be addressed from a climate perspective. It makes no sense. So the question is, how do we weigh that against the others?
Yes, well, I think one of my concerns is that, on the one hand, Europe is trying to negotiate with Iran, for example, saying, look, have use alternatives to nuclear, let alone when you get to countries that, for example, Central of Africa, where they, in order to develop, they want to have generation of electricity, and nuclear is clearly a very carbon-friendly way of doing it. It's got other problems, but the ethical problem is, how can Britain say it's okay for us, we can look after it, but whereas we turn around and say to other countries, oh, we don't trust you with nuclear generation.
I think we got that question. That's a good one. And we're not shying away from these hard questions.
No. Well, I think that, as you've probably seen today, all these are very complex issues. There's no simple answer. Now, Shoghi Effendi said we should be developing all available sources of energy.
Before you go on, saying who Shoghi Effendi is,
he was the guardian of a high faith. He was... He sort of led the Baha'i faith through 1921, 1957, but he provided a lot of guidance for the Baha'i community in that period.
He studied
it himself. He studied about it.
the historical mechanism. Well, no, but that he said we should be developing all available sources of energy on the surface of the planet. He didn't exclude any of them at that time. Well, if we look at nuclear in particular, it's an extremely difficult technology to manage safely. You know, the Russians and the Americans have had serious nuclear accidents, and they're pretty good engineers and so on. And it's the kind of technology where even a very remote failure can be disastrous at the moment. You know, the risk mentioned, that's why nobody wants to insure it. It's uninsurable, simply because if an accident occurs, you know, the impact can affect millions, hundreds of millions of people. Look what happened with Chernobyl and Western Europe and uninhabitable areas and so on. So one could easily say, well, there probably would have to be some standard of technical excellence and precision and care before you would want to trust anybody to work with such a technology. Not making any judgments in terms of nationalities, but simply the fact, because of the risk was so great, the Japanese have also had a series of accidents in their nuclear plants. Now, these are the world's best engineers. And if they can't do it right, we need to be a bit cautious about how far we go. There is also, of course, the ethical dimension of the long-term storage of nuclear waste. And no country has yet found a satisfactory way of storing things for 10,000 years, 20,000 years. So there's a moral issue about creating problems that cause future generations. But that, again, as Thomas said, you have to weigh that against the, you know, the damage we're doing to generations from climate change. It may be that given the global scale of that damage, weighing different kinds of damage, when they say as a transitional measure within some moderate level of, you know, what we are maybe physically able to store in the future, one might be able to argue that one could take a decision to continue use nuclear as part of a transition process. I think the moral issues involved are not simple, and particularly when you're trying to weigh our present benefits or short-term benefits against long-term liabilities. The economist's tendency to discount the future weighs very heavily in a kind of a moral distortion about what we should do for future generations. So that's not the perfect answer, but I at least wanted to check what are some of the dimensions of the ethical issues that are involved would have to be considered by decision maker in saying, and I think also if you were to say, I'm willing to do nuclear and I'm going to store the waste in my basement, you know, I'm going to put it in my own backyard and take the risk myself, that's one thing. If we're to do it and export the waste to some other country and let them take the risk, that I think is morally much more reprehensible.
Thanks, Minu.
Well, your question was how can the UK further develop its nuclear supply and say to other countries that they shouldn't? I'd say if the UK can't, not have an agreement, fine, but from my perspective, you can't do that. You know, you either argue in a just and fair way, or you don't. And the technical excellence or governance excellence I haven't seen the country that has done that, and I would say they're going to do it with your boss. So I'm very much on the female side of the opinion here. This is a very good example of the differences, by the way, where women are much, much more critical of using nuclear, and they are on technological fixes in the first place. And just to add on that one thing, if we do this, you frame it as a transitional whatever, it is not a solution to climate change, and it is not a solution that will tell us now to change our behavior. It won't. It will say we can continue for the next 40 years as we have uranium to do what we've been doing and deal with the consequences.
Thanks. Sylvia, being of the same sex and gender, possibly.
No, I mean, I tend to agree very much with that, and I think with the path of going into these large solutions, I mean, I'm not the one who looks at it in hours of detail or so, but I heard a person from IEA last week, and in their scenarios, nuclear doesn't play a very large part either in this coming century. And I would assume that that's for economical reasons. I mean, if you can't get the economics right for nuclear without enormous subsidies, it seems strange to go that road. I mean, and it's easy because, you know, it's one point of production, and as you know, saying, you can go into the same pattern of distribution and all the rest of it. Whilst, as the same presenter was talking about energy efficiency, he said it's really hard to make energy efficiency sexy or attractive, because no government official will kind of, you know, it's all these small measures everywhere. But you hear the figures, I don't know if Michael told you or someone else, you know, if everyone in the U.S. would turn off their standby mode, you could save one nuclear power plant, for example, and things like that. I mean, there are such huge potentials in these multiple small measures. All of them we can't do ourselves, because we need the technological innovation. And I would say we need strong global governance to set, for example, efficiency standards. They're all asking for it, but there is no one dares to actually ask an intergovernmental organization to rule that, because, you know, the business community wants to. They want them, but they don't want someone else
they
to rule them.
They want them for you. Yeah. They don't want them for themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. Can we move to the next question? Thanks. You can see the diversity of approaches, which I think is a very healthy diversity. Otherwise, it's kind of boring as well. So, Jenna, I think you have the next question.
Yeah. Why is such an emphasis placed on climate change rather than general environmental problems affecting our planet?
Why are we looking at climate change and not just general environmental? This is a heads up for the organizers for next year.
Necessarily enough emphasis being placed on climate change yet, and I must admit that, and this came through also in the presentation this morning, I hate to be too pessimistic, and I would try to be optimistic this morning, but I have close contacts with, for example, people that are working on science of climate change, and they're coming out next year with their next report, and at a personal level, I find this deep worry that we haven't really faced up to the severity of this problem. And my colleagues in that working on other environmental issues, they have also come to the conclusion that what they are working on, yes, it's important, but their success will be determined by our success. If I say our success. Take an example, biodiversity. Biodiversity losses is very important. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment looked at the causes, and currently land use change, deforestation, all these things are now the primary cause. But they say at least, I don't remember if they said after 20 years, but at least in the middle of the century, climate change is going to be the biggest driver for biodiversity loss. Another convention looks at land degradation and deforestation and desertification. They are basically seeing those impacts because of partly because of climate. There are the purer environmental agreements that definitely are critical for them, but they can actually achieve a lot without maybe requiring the whole attention of a full set of government actors and industry. One good example of this is the what they've done about the ocean lake. I mean, it's a handful of products with very clear purposes, and you can deal with it there. The persistent organic pollutants is extremely important issue, but you do not need to involve the whole economy in solving it. So what I'm trying to say is that the difference between climate change and the other environmental challenges is that the sheer number of actors is this order of magnitude greater, and therefore it cannot do it through specialized agencies. You cannot do it through very specialized agreements. You have to do it through much more penetrating actions. I think this answers the question.
I think, in any case, all developmental scores are related. You can't separate them out and just meet them with them in isolation. Each one has an influence on the others. And for a while, you know, a decade ago or so, climate change was something sort of off in the future. There were more immediate concerns about people being poisoned and, you know, and so on and so forth. With the accelerating evidence that climate change is happening much faster than expected and is happening now, the, you know, the priorities have been shifting. And the recognition that, in fact, you know, we may be simply swamped by this issue. The others will become very small in comparison. Whether you look at it in terms of the number of people impacted, you start looking at the number of people being polluted by PVCs or something like this, and you compare it to the number of people who are being flooded out by sea level rise linked to global warming, look at the economic impacts. We're here looking at hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars that may be involved. You know, there's a different scale of impact. There's a universality of impact to this issue that goes beyond many of the other environmental issues. So I think that's probably why you see the shift in priorities and the headlines, even in The Economist and so on, you know, environmental issues don't get the headlines in The Economist very often, that shows that this is the gift that's attacking things at a more basic level. And as I say, we're all involved in it. It's not a narrow industry or a group, and it's going to have an effect over a longer scale in space and time than any other issues, which is probably why it's present. But this, as with many other things in the environment, one issue we often carry the others along with it. And if you build better governmental cooperation on this issue, then you have a framework you can also tackle more these other issues. The kinds of transformations in society necessary to meet this sort of general challenge will give us finally the infrastructure that may then also take care of the others as well in the future.
Just a small comment. I mean, they're very difficult to compare in terms of the irreversibility. Of course, the biodiversity loss is irreversible. You never get the issues back. Land degradation can also be irreversible. There are different aspects of that. But I think the irreversibility aspect of climate change is at a different scale. Because on the one hand, you have no idea what the impact will be, but you certainly know we'll never be able to. It's just another magnitude, and also perhaps, I mean, that building on what Arthur was saying, we do care about human lives at first hand. I mean, we've been pretty poor in dealing with abject poverty and everything in our own generation, but we do care about it. And the facts and the figures, I mean, in terms of the implications of human well-being in the future are just so.
And yet it's been really hard to engage governments at any level with that concern in a direct way.
Yeah,
I mean, that's really where we are.
Well,
I mean, I think the point is that is going to have to change, along with climate change, and that's going to have to change as well. Any other comments from the. Does that answer your question? The next question is still.
What are the indicators required, or how do you envisage the process of reversing climate change in terms of being instrumental in poverty elimination? What are the indicators required, or how do you envisage the process of reversing climate change being instrumental in poverty elimination?
Certainly, when you look, as I shared those numbers with you a little while ago, much of the poverty reduction that has taken place in the last 20 years that can be traced to economic growth, especially China, which holds on to. There is very strong empirical evidence that shows this connection between growth and improvement, certainly in a positive direction. So one way to look at this is basically say that
that through better policies, through strengthening institutions, through investment in education, reduction in corruption, improvement in transparency, etc., 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 countries will increase the more people from poverty. Now, the problem is that when you look at China, the growth and the poverty reduction have brought with it a remarkable deterioration of the environment. Again, a good reference to this particular meeting I was attending in China this past week, with one of the panelists of this discussion of the director of the World Bank in China. He was saying that, in his view, this is the greatest challenge which the Chinese government faces in the world, that the speed with which the environment is deteriorating, on all of it, quality of air, water, etc., etc., is like overwhelming. A lady sitting on the panel who was a business school professor, been living in China for the past 14 years, later on she told me privately, I am glad that my children are blonde and they're studying abroad. I'm not sure that I would stay in Beijing if my children were small. I'm not sure that I would feel that I would be responsible for the parent to get my children there. So you have these issues. As Arthur has said very compellingly, getting policies right is very complicated. On the one hand, everybody wants the Chinese economy to grow 10% a year because it's population. Large. It is actually good for the rest of the global economy as well because it creates demand for commodities, that's led to increased trade, etc. On the other hand, you want to do this in a way that is sustainable. I learned a shocking statistic from that meeting. Somebody has bothered to calculate how many cars China will be producing by 2030. 63 million cars. You know, it's not going to happen. Sure, this is more car production per year than the United States has ever produced at the height of its development. But because China, by 2030, will probably be 6 million people, it's not as conceivable. But you know, you can't fit 6 million cars in Chinese highways. What sort of development of infrastructure are you going to have? And more importantly, what does this apply to the emissions? So we know that at some point, you know, between now and 2030, the system is going to break down in some way, and 63 million cars are not going to be produced. Or put it another way, we know that we're not going to have every Chinese driveway with two cars that we have had in the United States. We're going to have to confront these choices.
So, failing that disaster scenario, or how you see this disaster scenario, is really a system of mechanism. That talking here with looking at values and spirituality and so forth, we need to have on what else could happen other than just meltdown as an alternative to having that kind of scenario.
Let me just say one interesting thing. You know that when you think about economic growth, you take kind of a long term perspective, let's say the last 100 years, what you actually see is that the sources of growth have changed radically. Agriculture used to be tremendously important in the global economy, but over the last 50 years, the share of agriculture in total has shrunk. You have a country like the United States, which is an agricultural power, where basically a tiny percent of the population produces the entire agriculture. So, when I ask myself, is it possible for the global economy, at least in theory, to grow, let's say, a very healthy growth rate, 5-6%? While at the same time doing it in a way that would preserve the environment and that would allow us to address some of the very problems. And the answer to that question is possible. If in fact the nature of economic output begins to shift not only away from agriculture, which is already combined, away from industry, heavy industry, which is already doing, and goes more and more into high technology and non-materialized. It's interesting. Israel, in the year 2000, grew by 6%. This was before the end of the Fatah. And the Israeli Central Bank did a very interesting study which actually showed that out of that 6% inflow, 2 percentage points, one third of it, was immaterial. What does it mean? It was software production, intellectual output, technological innovation, which of course has no negative impact on the environment. It is literally exports that get generated for the country by transferring files and new software development from Israel to the external market. Now think of it. If in the future we become more and more there is more and more technological innovation, which basically allows us to produce things in more and more efficient ways, which we use less and less resources. In other words, the efficiency of the resources that we use increases more and more and more. Then it is conceivable, at least theoretically, maybe it won't happen for other reasons, but at least theoretically, it is conceivable to have a growing level of prosperity, while at the same time still being able to manage the climate.
That's a different perspective. I mean, economic growth may be one answer to it. I'm looking at poverty, the other traditional one, I would say, is redistribution. And, this is not a very popular term anymore. But what we've seen over the last decade is an enormous widening of the gap between rich and poor within countries and between countries, which is extremely unhealthy. It's explosive in terms of conflict. And, you know, there's calculations that the gap is so and so wide, then you have that likelihood of violent conflict within the country and so on. Even from that perspective, I think it's very important that if you say growth, then that kind of economy is designed in a way that does not allow the obscene type of wealth that we have in the hands of very few people nowadays, and the abject poverty of still a very large number of people. So I would, I'm not an economist, but I do believe in redistribution anyway. And the second thing is a remark maybe from a German perspective. When the country after the Second World War was pretty flat out bombed out, yes, we were very industrious. Women cleaned away the rubble and all that, but we also had the Marshall Plan, which helped the Germany to recover. And, there's a global campaign about the Marshall Plan in the developing world. I'm not necessarily aligning myself with that, but it's reminding of the fact that it needs a significant investment in development when countries are flat on the ground or poor. And I think there's something to learn from that. The third point I wanted to make is, we talk about poverty and talk about wealth, and we talked about are people actually happy when they're poor, when they're rich, and this curve that you usually see. From my perspective, climate change is such a fundamental problem, and such an enormous challenge that we need to address it even more fundamentally than to say what instruments do we have. We have things like the way our economy is ticking. We have those kinds of sectors. I would appreciate if we look even more deeply and say, what is it? What is a good life as a human? And if we create that the opportunity to ask that question in communities around the world, and looking at their rich or their poor. That sounds incredibly unrealistic, and I think it can be done.
Just a quick comment here. The anecdote from Beijing actually links to the earlier question on the other environmental issues. Currently, air quality is a big thing there. I mean, that's purely an environmental issue that has been neglected, actually. There's cooperation for the from the acid rain period in the north, but there's no international cooperation on air quality and urban air quality, and that's a gap that needs to be filled. And you gain on climate change at the same time. But coming back to the question though of the indicators, what is it that you need to know to see if you're making progress on these things? And the concept that I think you need to think of there is vulnerability. When we talk about climate impacts, and it's important to know the exposure, then are you in the drought-affected area? But then the next question is, how vulnerable are you to that impact and that exposure to drought, for example? Do you have access to irrigation systems? Do you have storage? And here, becomes very critical, at least for farmers. They can take one drought in 4 years, but it could be difficult for them to take two subsequent years of drought. And so vulnerability is a key indicator. And what I find interesting is that the state of development is the largest component to that. And so development, in a way, is a way to deal with the impact of climate change. And I think as countries, as economies evolve, they become less and less vulnerable and sensitive to climate variation as well as climate change. And I don't want to belabor this point, but I mean, there are a lot of examples of this, where poor countries are extremely vulnerable to rainfall fluctuations, even the GDP of Morocco. You can actually see the rainfall impact in the GDP year to year, and so it's really the vulnerability that we need to look at, and that's how you deal with adaptation, is that you reduce the vulnerability.
I thought the design and the carbon opening index is big internationally that captures this, and therefore, by raising development within the poor and most vulnerable, so by raising their level of development, you reduce their vulnerability, and therefore, that's one of the best measures of being able to resist the changes that we're already now. I think also, Rooster was saying about growth and say American agriculture and so on, much of our recent growth past has been energy subsidies. And that subsidy is being withdrawn as the prices go up. And the future is much more going back to agriculture, going back to renewable resources for the future society. So part of our challenge is to find indicators of it that will steer us back towards the long-term sustainable resources as opposed to the short-term ones that we've built most of our economies on now, which means that indicators of decoupling of energy from development or economics are incredibly, incredibly important. How well are we dematerializing our societies? How well is the economy not drawing on resources that we can pollute or depend on energy inputs and so on, and are steering development towards things that are more intellectual, scientific, cultural, social, and spiritual? Those are there to be developing indicators that we capture the kind of shift we're looking for.
I'm going to close this question. We're actually at the end of time. We start 15 minutes later. We're supposed to go for another 15 minutes. Is that going to be okay? Does that answer your question or give you a range of questions? Sam, you have the next question.
Good evening, panel. This question is for the entire panel. Given the complexity of the issues concerning the problem of combating global warming, of climate change and its effects, how does the panel see the current world governments, their and their disunity in their effectiveness and collective approach towards solving these issues and in their efforts?
George, you have a question at the back about governance institutions. Let's have a go at this one. Sylvia, come on.
Of course, this unity has an enormous impact on the inability of moving forward. This unity, from my understanding, coming from vastly different short-term national interests. The short-term interests are very different if you focus only on economic and material development. If you are an oil-producing country, if you are a low island state, if you are agriculture-dependent country, if you focus on those aspects and only on the interests of your own population living now, there is not so much ground to come towards unity. So you have to somehow, I usually talk about this like you have two paths and they're kind of supporting each other. You can try, which the governments are not really moving towards, is to create a kind of enlightened self-interest, which which means that governments and people, I mean, awareness is raising. And, I mean, that sounds terrible, but thanks to the signs of climate change actually already happening, it's becoming more real. It's becoming a self-interest already now. And that, of course, supports the desire to do something about it. And I mean, if you can link that also, that you're kind of interested also in your children's well-being. You know, that for me supports the process. And, I mean, that actors are starting to see they all have a cake, and I mean, they all have something coming out. They all have a stake in addressing it. But
take the soul.
I have plenty of cake. That will be an important motivating factor, I think. But I don't. Well, in the long run, it's still going to be very hard because of the lock-in in institutions that force you to think. Or, you know, if you just focus on the national self-interest, you know, somehow have to get over that bridge and institutionalize the caring of also the neighbors' interests. And so the other path that I hope will, you know, be strengthened is really to have, you know, more altruistic concerns and say, okay, you know, we don't know, because I mean it's very hard to know exactly how each economy is going to be affected. So I mean, calculating the cost benefit for an individual country is just whether, you know, it's better to just ignore climate change and suffer the consequences. I mean, that's very difficult. But so it would really require enormous amount of data and things like that to rely on purely rational economic models. And I'm not an economist, so I'm kind of simplifying things. But if you then go the other path of saying, you know, well, we do care about the fate of humanity as a whole. We put, you know, really a lot of caring, whether they're very few people, but they are still people living in countries that will disappear, you know, that you develop that kind of attachment to the fate of other people, then the evidence is there that, you know, we have to do something for love of humanity.
This is a very fundamental question, and I hinted in my presentation this morning that perhaps solving climate change will fundamentally change the way governments work together, and that by that I mean basically the world governments. And I have mentioned a couple of times my attraction to trying to establish environment-based regimes, which you actually believe. But the difficulty with that in the current international structure is that you then have to have each and every country ratify and accept those rules. And that is a step that then is very much based on national self-interest in a very and it's very much a subject of political questions. When Russian Federation was looking at its decision to ratify, it was clearly an offer by the European Union to help with their accession to the World Trade Organization that led to the Russian ratifying Kyoto. And so you can, in some cases, but nobody is powerful enough to offer anything to the United States that would make them change their mind. So this is the limit that we have now. But we have to work within the structures that we have at the moment. Step by step, then, these treaties establish, they strengthen the government. And because governments increasingly we see it in their interest to be a part of that rule-based regime rather than the outside of it. I don't think it is, we can wait for a more fundamental transformation where perhaps one would look more seriously at the national sovereignty issue as a basis for international cooperation. I don't see that, I mean, we can't really wait for that thing to change. But I think it's more of the problems we face that changes the way we cooperate. And that's why I think there will be more, the change in governance will be more a result of us having solved climate change rather than the cause of us being solved. If you understand my thinking. Just a very quick observation as well. I didn't go into this very much, but one of the biggest weaknesses of the climate convention was negotiated at the end of the 1990s, is that it solidified categories, two categories of companies. Annex 1, basically OECD and companies in the countries and the rest of the world. And it's been extremely difficult to reopen that categorization. And that's where the battle will be fought. And so that is one of those weaknesses where you see quite a lot of black and white, and that we need, might need to start working.
Yes. Well, we have a situation of an immovable object, governments, and an irresistible force, climate change. And we've already seen the inability of the existing governance systems to respond. They're paralyzed by consensus, you know, they're taking lowest common denominator, they're constantly struggling, everything goes into brackets and nothing moves in the negotiating process. I personally think that the one thing that might unblock the situation would be if business comes out and says, we need stronger governance. Because the economic argument is the argument that carries weight with even countries like the United States. And if the business leaders put pressure on the governments to begin to yield these blockages and to force them to come to the negotiating table and strengthen the government's institutions, that might be a way of sort of leapfrogging forward rather than trying to struggle through this impossible situation that we have now.
Thanks. Final question from Phil. And we're just going to have one sentence.
That's a more general question. Agenda 21. The Agenda 21 initiative demonstrated the weaknesses of local government in implementing strategies for sustainable development at the local community level. Given that the Commission for Sustainable Development estimated 2/3 of development will come from local initiatives, what can the Baha'i model of governance and participatory democracy offer the world?
Well, a lot, I would think.
as you know, I come from Germany, we haven't been as active and as much investment in the local agenda as we want in Germany as it has been in the UK, including the involvement of black communities. But I would think that, let's just talk about consultation. The way consultation is set out in the rights, very, very effective laws, you all know, because very effective laws are supposed to be done. It is, from a research point of view, it is a very efficient way to bring about decisions and to bring about the implementation of those decisions. So I would hope that we share a bit more about our experiences with consultation in our tedious meetings that we have, that do deliver for the community. So I would just say good process, and we have some experience with that. Not all of that is good experience, it's cumbersome. But to export that means to share with people how we're running ourselves and what works. I think that it's very appreciated if we do.
Yes, my dear. So, any good tips about this one?
In some way, to summarize the high level of consultation, because there are a number of hospitals here, but they're wondering what is this?
Yes. But yeah, go with that.
All right. We do have an assembly-based model, so you have assemblies being elected at the local national level. The elected system itself is really cool, but just to talk about how the assemblies themselves interact and how you're supposed to consult. You're supposed to, for example, always speak your mind, even if the 8 other people that are in the assembly share a different opinion. You're supposed to be frank and honest. You're supposed to air your ideas and then let go of them. They belong to the group. You're supposed to listen respectfully to what everybody else has to say. You're supposed to make sure that everybody really puts their ideas and thinking into the process. You're supposed to strive for consensus. And if that can't be reached, take a moment to try again. If that can't be reached, go for the majority. And some of these simple rules are extremely effective. For example, if you say what you think and what should be done, and then take a step back and say, this now belongs to the group. There's a whole lot of ego that goes out of the group by doing that. So I think I've forgotten a few.
Arthur's going to fill in the blank.
Yeah.
The process of consultation also includes discerning the facts. What are the facts of the case? What are the principles that are involved? And if you're consulting on something like Agenda 21, you have a certain number of environmental facts and social practices to look at in your local community. You then say, what are the principles involved? Agenda 21 was an attempt by governments to distill principles for sustainability. But then you also need to add the spiritual principles, the ethical principles, that are best expressed at the local level. And on the basis of that, then you draw together the diverse opinions of all the different facets of community understanding. So it is a process that can carry anyone much further than the traditional democratic debate, which is more competitive, and allows looking for a unity that includes everybody. It's much more inclusive. And that inclusive buy-in is what allows implementation. If people are, the tragedy of the democratic system is half are always trying to make you fail, they're never trying to succeed. With consent, with a Baha'i consultative process, rather than applying those principles, we try to reach the point where everybody says, we're all going to try this solution together. If it doesn't work, then we'll see it's not working, and we can change it and do something else. But it's also a kind of adaptive management, which is very well Agenda 21 and addressing environmental issues.
Sylvia.
So building on what was explaining of the different levels of administration we have in the community. In linking that to Agenda 21, in Sweden, where I come from, Agenda 21 was very, very much in fashion in the first years after the Rio summit. Almost every, if not every single municipality had a process, multi-stakeholder dialogues, etc. That process has kind of, now I was at a conference a couple of years ago, kind of the spirit is really way down. It's half died out. And there are no staff assigned to it anymore, etc. And I think maybe one, as I understood it, lesson from that is what they were kind of, they could do certain things at the municipal level, certainly about engaging roads and processes and things like that, education, awareness raising. But there were a number of more radical things, you know, about transport, about things, where they really, they hit the glass ceiling because the policies came from the national or even international level. So, I mean, and actually in the international process, I mean, in Johannesburg Summit, all the focus was on, well, countries need national sustainable development strategies, you know, it wasn't enough for Global Agenda 21. We now kind of need a supportive framework. And we know that we also need a supportive international framework. And taking that parallel to the Baha'i community, that is really, for me, with the, not only the administrative bodies we have at local, national, international level, but the way that decisions and information flows through them and the kind of unity they create, you know, really to that the local unit feels really connected to the global community. That is what we need, and that's for me the most important lesson of linking those levels.
Thank you very much. The chair is going to ask the final question. This is a one-sentence answer from each of you, or even a one-word question. All of us have come here this wonderful weekend to hear all of you and others here. If there was one thing that each individual could go away and do one thing that would make a difference immediately, tomorrow, what would you say would be that one thing they could do? Listen.
I guess we all have to constantly re-examine, you know, our lifestyle to you know, make a distinction between those things that are you know, important and essential for true human happiness and those things that are, you know, simply things that we do because of habit, because others are doing it, and which have very little to do really with our spiritual development. And I think a lot of the problems that we have with the environment at large is because we don't establish this distinction.
Thank you very much. Minu?
Yeah, choose freedom, get rid of everything we don't need.
Thank you. Other.
Thank you, so to our panel. Thank you, Ralph, for the questions. I'll see you at the end.
Sylvia?
You stole my sentence.
Sharing.
Whatever sentence.
Yes, that's fine.
Just like, we should hold ourselves to account before we can change patterns we start.
Arthur.
Pray. We need a whole help you can get.
Well, thank you very much for your talent. And thank you also to questions that we've managed to get them asked. I have on entire folders of questions that were not asked. I gather there's another panel tomorrow with those questions. I'm going to pass them on to the organizers and they can be answered another time. Thank you very much.
For the dinner tonight,